Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
John Stuart Mill and The Good Life.
Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family.
Mill thinks the good life is the life that I choose.
So which is it? Is it better to choose a life of suffering or live happily in somebody else's vision?
This is my life. This is it. I spent 26 years waiting for something else to start, so no, I don't think it's too much to take on because it's everything there is. I see now it's all there is.
Choose your future. Choose life.
Would you rather be a pig satisfied or Socrates dissatisfied?
Our guest is David Brink, author of Mill's Progressive Principles.
I am not going to sit on my ass as the events that affect me unfold to determine the course of my life. I'm going to take a stand.
Mill and the Good Life.
I'm going to defend it.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Right or wrong, I'm going to defend it.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. What is the good life?
Are we each free to decide which life is best for us?
Is a life good because I choose it? Or do I choose it because it's good?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 or 45 years.
Yeah, John, and it's nice to have our host emeritus back in the studio for a day. Thanks so much.
Nice to be back, Ken.
So today, we're thinking about John Stuart Mill and the good life.
Well, Mill, I guess, I mean, he's on liberty. He's really big on individual choice. He says that a person's, this is a quote, own mode of laying out his existence is best. Not because it is best in itself, but because it is in his own mode, end quote.
I love Mill's emphasis on freedom and self-actualization, not letting yourself be cowed into conformity by, and here's another quote, the despotism of custom, or browbeaten into accepting orthodoxy by what he calls the tyranny of the prevailing opinion. That's really good stuff, John.
Well, I like it too, Ken. But, you know, I guess I've never been able to understand how Mill can believe all that and at the same time be a utilitarian.
Well, wait a minute. What's the problem?
Well, utilitarians think that you should always do that which produces the greatest happiness for the greatest number, right?
Well, yeah, that's one way they put it.
Well, there's a tension there. Look, example, I know how much you love doing philosophy.
I sure do.
But suppose that you could, in fact, make more people happy by being a lawyer. You take up the law, you become a crusader for human rights. Instead of making, you know, a significant number of philosophy students significantly better off, you make thousands of people really better off. But you're miserable doing it. Would you consider doing it?
No, because you said the thing. I think I might be a good lawyer, but I wouldn't be happy as a lawyer. I'd be miserable as a lawyer.
But you're just one person, Ken. I mean, I have to break it to you, but that's it. And in the calculus of the greatest good for the greatest number, your individual happiness doesn't matter any more than anyone else's.
Look, John, I don't want to sound too terribly selfish, but frankly, I'm just not willing. I'm just not to sacrifice my own happiness at the altar of the happiness of others. I'm just not willing to do that.
But aren't utilitarians? Isn't that the idea? I mean, some of them would want me to sacrifice my happiness, not just for the greater good of all of mankind, but the greater good of all of animal kind.
Yeah, but that's Peter Singer. He does say that kind of thing. But Mill doesn't say that sort of thing. I mean, how could he? He's the man who says, here's a quote, another quote from Mill. He who lets the world, or his own portion of it, choose his plan of life for him has no need of any other faculty than the ape-like one of imitation.
Well, yes, thank you. You've explained. why I am puzzled. What kind of utilitarianism is that?
Well, it's like, it's the kind, for one thing, I know, it's the kind that doesn't count all pleasures or all happiness as equal. I mean, think of what he says about, you know, philosophers and pigs, for example.
Well, I think what he's supposed to have said is it's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. I think that's what distinguishes Mill from Bentham and from Mill's own father. This, you know, comparative happiness. But how does that help us here?
Well, just think about it. It shows that happiness is not like, it's not like a fungible commodity necessarily. And so because happiness is not fungible, sacrificing the happiness of one Socrates, even for the sake of a million happy pigs, well, that's not a good bargain, according to Mill.
Okay, but let's just stick to humans. Would it be a good utilitarian bargain to trade the happiness of one former philosopher turned crusading lawyer, no longer happy as a crusading lawyer, for the happiness of a million ordinary Janes and Joes whose life he improves with his lawyerliness?
Look, I don't even think Mill would make that a bargain. I don't really know, but I don't think he would. Because, I mean, he says I'm not allowed to harm other people. That's his famous harm principle. But I don't think he thinks I'm morally required to sacrifice my happiness for the greater good. I don't think he thinks that at all.
Well, I just don't see what kind of utilitarianism allows you to thumb your nose at the greater good in the name of your individual liberty and happiness.
Well, I think a subtle and sophisticated kind. That's what Scott...
In other words, a kind that is above my head and I can't understand. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I bet you think it's more incoherent.
Yeah, I think it's incoherent.
Yeah, look, but I think that you're thinking about utility too narrowly. I mean, remember what Mill says in On Liberty when he's talking about utility. He says he means, quote, utility in the largest sense, grounded in the permanent interest of man as a progressive being. See?
Yeah, that's the old philosophical device. Oh, you think P is kind of obscure. How about P plus yada, 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 yada?
No, John.
Oh, that's perfect.
No, John, come on. Ask yourself, come on, let's be fair to Mill. Ask yourself this question. Would allowing the individual to be sacrificed for the good of the collective, like as a general rule, would that actually serve humanity's collective interest in its own progress? I think the answer is obvious. No, it wouldn't. That would be a recipe for tyranny and oppression to me, not freedom and autonomy.
Well, Ken, I will concede you this much. Mill is a complicated and sophisticated thinker, and there's a lot to sort out here.
And to help us sort it out, we sent a roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to dig into an area where individual freedom and the collective interest quite often seem to conflict. She files this report.
Bailey Kirkaby is a rising senior at Bear Creek High School in Stockton, California. This past year, she wrote a controversial profile for her school newspaper.
Students are often told to follow their dreams and pursue what they love. An 18-year-old senior at Bear Creek, who recently started a career in adult entertainment, is doing just that.
The piece profiles a fellow high school student who makes her own erotic videos.
When I first started selling, it was just for money, Fink said. But then I liked the attention I got, such as being called beautiful.
Bailey remembers a lot of people criticizing the student's life choices.
This is what she's wanted to do, and this is the path that she wanted to take, and she's happy with it.
Caitlin Flanagan, a writer for The Atlantic magazine, thought people who read that piece should have been more concerned.
An 18-year-old girl from a troubled home should not be making pornography to pay rent while she tries to graduate from high school. We know that's not right.
John Stuart Mill encourages people to pursue higher pleasures, like listening to Beethoven or enjoying a nice day at the theater. Flanagan says making sexual videos was not quite what Mill had in mind.
The idea that a Victorian could possibly imagine an 18-year-old girl performing multiple sexual acts with men she doesn't know, that would just melt John Stuart Mill's mind down to nothingness.
It's easy for anyone in the digital age to sell porn and to consume it. That does raise questions about harm and liberty. Shira Tarrant is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at CSU Long Beach. She's also a fan of John Stuart Mill. People don't ask her about the guy enough.
I have never had anybody ask me about the link between John Stuart Mill and pornography.
Terrence says Mill's ideas are handy when it comes to moving past the one-dimensional is porn good, is porn bad, yes or no debate.
When these arguments around pornography are driven by passion and emotion and morality or even religion, that can interfere with really clear-headed thinking.
She says that if Mill were asked to give a lecture on pornography today, it would likely be informed by his wife, Harriet Taylor Mill.
He had a concern about women and women's political rights, largely due to his partner having concerns about women's rights.
Harriet Taylor Mill says pleasure would be, quote, infinitely heightened by the perfect equality of the sexes. With that in mind, Terrence says Mr. Mill would likely start this imaginary lecture with the harm principle.
The government can only interfere in individuals' liberty if doing so prevents harm from coming to others. Other than that, John Stuart Mill says people have the right to be free, to seek rational pleasure, to express themselves.
The question of whether porn causes harm is where this gets complicated. And so, at this point in the fantasy lecture, health experts might break down the data on both sides. Mill doesn't want us to sit back and be indifferent.
If I don't like porn or I think that pornography is harmful, I can try to convince you not to watch porn. I can engage in free speech and open debate on this topic. I could even, according to Mill, beg you to not watch porn. But according to Mill, I cannot force you to stop watching porn. And more importantly, neither can the government.
There are lots of pleasures out there in the world. Higher pleasures, lower pleasures. Pleasures that are medium low or on the lower end of high. Some people enjoy porn, others enjoy learning to play Duke Ellington on the saxophone. And there are good reasons to criticize porn. But there was also a time when people said jazz caused dementia and sexual deviance. At the end of the day, there is no harm in sticking to the science.
Hey man, got a big box of porn for you.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly, for that fascinating piece on the dubious pleasures of porn and other illicit things. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, John Perry. And today, we're thinking about Mill and the Good Life.
We're joined now by David Brink. David is professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of the book, Mill's Progressive Principles. David, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Hi, John. Hi, Ken.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us, David. David, you know, I love teaching Mill. I don't write about Mill, but I love teaching Mill to undergraduates. I'm not sure I would dare write about Mill. So I'm wondering, what first got you so fascinated with this complicated figure that you decided you actually spend a good portion of your adult life writing books and articles about the dude? What made you want to do that?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it was wrestling with the sorts of parent tensions anyway in Mill's views that you outlined at the beginning of the program. Mill's the founding contributor to the utilitarian tradition and to the liberal tradition, and it's not clear that belief in promoting happiness and respecting individual rights are fully compatible. And it was teaching these materials, as every young assistant professor does, to undergraduates in moral and political philosophy classes that led me to be puzzled by these issues and to see if I could work out answers and see if Mill could be defended as having a coherent and consistent view.
Well, it sounds like you're the perfect person to figure out what was dividing Ken and I. I'm just not sure all of Mill's good ideas can be reconciled. Ken's a little more sanguine. So what do you think? Is Mill's philosophy more like chunky peanut butter or smooth peanut butter?
Well, it's probably got to be pretty chunky. I'm just hoping that it doesn't end up with the peanut butter and the oil completely separating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good puzzle that John raises about the compatibility of the utilitarianism and the rights to liberty. And I think Mill has some resources to reconcile those two commitments. I think it's up for grabs just how far he succeeds, but I think it's quite an interesting project.
So can you give me the, if I were to put just a button, we had our discussion, we're gonna dig into this some more. If you were to give me the secret though, because John's got a real puzzle. If you could just, if you said the cocktail version of how to think about Mill's utilitarianism together with what some people call his perfectionism, right? Just tell me the secret sauce that would help tie that together if you can briefly.
Yeah, well, so I suppose I think the best prospects for reconciling his commitments to individual rights to liberty with a belief in promoting the general happiness is, as you suggest, the nature of his assumptions about happiness, in particular his perfectionism, which I interpret as claiming that the ingredients of happiness are not pleasure or the satisfaction of desire primarily, but are instead the exercise of those powers that make us responsible agents, roughly our rational capacities and capacities for practical reasoning. And if that's true, or something like that's true, then I think autonomy becomes a really important contributor of individual happiness. And that begins to explain some of the central claims, distinctive claims, defending liberalism and on liberty.
I think I got it. It's key in on what he really means by happiness, is how I might put a button on it. And that's a complicated thing, but we'll dig into that complicated thing after a break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about John Stuart Mill and the Good Life with David Brink from UC San Diego.
Does freedom of speech, action, and thought always serve the greatest good for the greatest number? I doubt it. Isn't some speech worth censoring, some ideas worth suppressing, and some ways of life worth prohibiting?
Freedom, harm, and happiness, when Philosophy Talk continues. Is it better to take the expert's advice on what's best for you, or do you stand your ground because it's your life, after all? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and Tom Petty's for that matter. I'm John Perry, and we're thinking about John Stuart Mill and the Good Life. Our guest is David Brink from UC San Diego, author of Mill's Progressive Principles.
So, David, you know, you said that Mill's like the, one of the founding fathers of the liberal tradition, one of the founding fathers of utilitarianism, and all that's really cool. And here's the thing that puzzles me. He thinks he can get all good things. It seems like maybe he thinks he can get all the good things out of freedom, like freedom of speech and thought and action, anti-paternalism, the importance of individuality, even genius, the importance of genius, prohibitions against the subjugation of women. He thinks he can get all those good things, apparently, out of utilitarianism. I'm not even sure he can get any of those good things out of utilitarianism, to tell you the truth. But I want you, let's give Mill his best case. Give me, like, your best Mill-inspired utilitarian argument for something like freedom of speech. Tell me how it works.
Okay, yeah, it's probably good to start with freedom of speech, because after the introductory chapter in On Liberty, where Mill sets out the harm principle, which he believes in, and censorship, which he opposes, and paternalism, which he opposes, and offense regulation, which he opposes, he turns in the very next chapter to freedom of expression. And the reason he gives us for why he wants to treat freedom of expression first is that he thinks that there's general agreement, maybe not universal agreement, but general agreement about the importance of expressive liberties, but that we don't fully understand why we value expressive liberties, and that once we understand why we value expressive liberties, we not only learn something important about freedom of expression, but we can extend it to other kinds of liberties. So in the argument about freedom of expression, he gives several reasons for opposing censorship, and they fall into two groups. One is a kind of truth-tracking rationale that says, as Justice Holmes would later say in Schenck versus United States, that open trade and the free market of ideas is the best test for truth. He suggests that a policy of freedom of expression and anti-censorship is most likely to lead to truth, at least in the long run. But he also says that we want to be able to explain why freedom of expression would be important even if the censor were to censor all and only false beliefs.
Right.
And the truth-tracking rationale can't explain that. So he appeals to our interest in exercising these capacities for decision-making and adopting ideals and implementing them in our lives and experiments in living. And we're cognitively limited beings, and we need to discuss with other people not only the options before us, but their merits in order to exercise these sort of normative powers.
That's a lot there. Let's unpack, because you said there were two kinds of arguments. There's like, okay, open discussion is going to get us closer to the truth. But you know what? Fox News, I'm just going to pick on Fox News. Fox News letting them into the discussion, how's that going to get us to the truth? They know they're not committed to the truth. They're committed to blather and propaganda.
Hey, Ken, Tucker Carlson convinced Trump not to invade.
That's true. So how do, I mean,
they do something right occasionally.
Some people whose idea, who are not committed to the truth, whose ideas won't, are engaging them, won't advance the truth. So why should I let all ideas flourish? Aren't there some ideas that I could just say, those are not discussable? Those are stupid.
Yeah, well,
those are pernicious.
I think that's one kind of limitation of the truth-tracking argument. One is that, first of all, it's just not clear that a complete opposition to censorship is the most likely policy to advance true ideas. I mean, if we're just comparing two stark alternatives between censorship whenever the censor sees fit and no restrictions whatsoever on speech, then maybe free speech is more likely to promote true beliefs in the long run. But there are lots of intermediate possibilities involving more conservative forms of censorship or subjecting speech to sort of critical disciplines of fact-checking and things like that. And so it's not obvious that you get at least a libertarian conception of free speech from the truth-tracking rationale.
But
the
now,
other worry...
Now, David, sorry. whether you take the libertarian conception or some more watered down conception, it seems like when talking about freedom of speech, you're talking about a policy. And so it seems like what we've got here must be rule utilitarianism. Can you explain the difference and tell me, was Mill a rule utilitarian or an act utilitarian?
One of you should explain that distinction.
I'll let David explain it because he knows what he's talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, so act utilitarianism is the view that we apply the test of utility directly to acts, so that if you're choosing between two acts, A and B, you should choose the action of those two that has the better consequences for human happiness. Rule utilitarianism is the view that we don't apply the test of utility directly to actions. Instead, we apply them to things like rules and principles. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to act according to the rule or principle that, when internalized, has the best consequences for human happiness. And some people have thought that rule utilitarianism would deliver less counterintuitive results about which actions are obligatory and which actions are permissible.
This goes back to the thing I was trying to say at the end to John. If you consider the long-term happiness of man as a progressive species, right, you might say, well, look, if you had a rule that says you could always subvert the individual to the collective, that would be bad. If you had a rule that let the individual sometimes thumb his or her nose at the collective, but sometimes not upon their choice, that would be good. It's not the particular act that you look at. It's like, what kind of rule should we have? I mean, it seems to me, if you're going to be a utilitarian, you ought to be a rule utilitarian. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I usually thought that Mill was a rule utilitarianism. That's why his father got mad at him. But now reading David's book, I'm not so sure anymore.
Yeah.
So clear this all up.
Okay. So I think the most important takeaway lesson is just that Mill is committed to the importance of rules and principles. And I think it's especially natural in the sort of governmental or political sphere where you're thinking about what kinds of policies is the government going to adopt? What sorts of laws are they going to enact? And they're presumably not going to enact laws about particular individuals on particular occasions. They're going to enact rules. And even in the individual case, deciding what to do, an individual has to have rules and principles that she internalizes and acts on. And I think it's really clear that Mill thinks that we should test different rules or principles by their effects on the general happiness. That doesn't itself settle the question about whether he's an act or rule utilitarian, because act utilitarians can think that when you're choosing rules, you should choose the rules with the best consequences. So I don't think whether Mill insists on the importance of optimal rules settles whether he's a rule or act utilitarian.
But again, help me think. Okay, so you gave two arguments, that Mill has two arguments. There was this truth-tracking one, which you agree is kind of problematic, and Mill seems to recognize it because he gives another argument, and that's this capacities kind of argument, right? He says something in On Liberty that I always get students to try to see. You know, even if you believe the truth, that's not really good for human flourishing if you believe the truth as a dead dogma rather than something living and combating falsity and always having to show that you know how to combat the false opinion and you don't just take this opinion, this belief on reflex. That's a good thing, right? What do you think of that argument? Is that a better argument?
Yeah, I think it's a better, stronger, more robust argument, in part because it's designed to show that we'd have reason to oppose censorship even if the censor only censored false beliefs. So even if under a rule of censorship we all held true beliefs, as you just said, Mill thinks that, but if we hold them unthinkingly and without understanding their rationale and their justification, then that wouldn't be valuable, that would be meaningless. And at one point Mill makes this point by distinguishing, as philosophers do, between true belief and knowledge. And he thinks, and here's, I think, partly where the appeal to the perfectionist conception of rational capacities might be relevant. He thinks that we're really interested in knowledge and not just true belief. And knowledge requires that we hold true beliefs in the right sort of way, in a way that's justified. And that requires understanding the grounds for the beliefs that are true. And in order to fully understand them, we need to confront alternative conceptions of what's true. And we need to test our beliefs against rivals. And in order to do that, we need open discussion among interlocutors with different beliefs and mindsets.
Okay, now we've got an email. David in Nevada City, he says, Mill sounds like the founder of the conservative right. With Mill, who decides what behavior is harmful to others? Can I pollute and shoot endangered animals because I want to? I say it's not harmful to anyone. What does what you have to say have to do with it?
What do you think, David?
Well, so this alludes to the harm principle, which is an important principle for Mill that we haven't really talked directly about. He sets it out at the beginning of On Liberty, and at one point he suggests that the whole version of his liberalism could be reduced to the simple claims of the harm principle, that is, that the only legitimate reason for restricting anyone's liberty is to prevent harm to others. I think that eventually gets qualified in significant ways. But anyway, it's an important part of Mill's principle. But I mean, we have to make determinations about what is harmful and what's not. And the only way to do that is to have some conception about what's in someone's interest, because harm is something like a setback of an important interest. And so it seems like in order to figure out what's harmful, we have to figure out what people have an interest in and what their happiness consists
in. Let's pursue that further, because one of the things I teach On Liberty every year to freshmen, and one of the things they don't get, they think Mill thinks that speech per se cannot be a harm. But they think, no, if somebody disses me in speech, if somebody hurts my feelings, if they insult me, if they demean me, they harm me, right? And I say, well, look, you got to distinguish offense from harm. Is offense necessarily a harm or not? And we get going back and forth about offense versus harm. Does Mill have a way of drawing a principled distinction between, as it were, mere offense and genuine harm?
You're right that it's important to understanding the harm principle that he distinguishes between mere offense and harm. And I think we're all familiar with examples of the distinction. So if I tell a tasteless joke, that may offend you, but it doesn't harm you. If I undermine your professional credibility and job applications, I've probably harmed you. So we have this notion of a harm being much more significant, less ephemeral, the setback of an important interest. Now, Mill gives examples of what are mere offenses and what count as harms. He doesn't give a general theory except for the claim that something counts as a harm in case it violates the interests of an assignable individual,
right,
the rights of an assignable individual. But that's not a algorithm for distinguishing between offense and harm, and there are probably going to be cases that are in the gray area. But we want to resist the inflationary tendency to treat everything you don't like as a harm.
Right. Mill thinks you are not entitled to anybody's good opinion or to anybody's company, right? But you are entitled to a kind of respect. But see, I think we don't really... Mill thinks, I don't know if Mill thinks he's like articulating common sense in a kind of Socratic midwife form, right? These are implicit in our practices, or if he's telling us from on high, these are the principles you ought to adopt. Because I think it's really hard for people to separate out what's disrespect from, you know, what's your entitlement to shun me? You know what I mean? Can Mill somehow help us think about that?
Well, I think you're right that there's... There are going to be these gray areas, and I think it would be maybe some people who understand utilitarianism as this formula for determining what's right and wrong think that there's going to be an algorithm coming out of the Millian corpus for telling us what's mere offense and what's harm. I think that's a mistake to suppose that he's going to be giving us an easy test for solving all our practical questions. I think he directs our attention to the idea that in order for something to qualify as a harm, it has to set back an important interest that it's reasonable for people to claim as a right. And one of the things he thinks makes something a right is that the government has a duty to enforce it. And that's going to depend on which interests are really essential to people's well-being and happiness. And it's not going to just depend on what they care about at the moment or what they find annoying or inconvenient.
So David, I mean, contemporary technology really makes this important because we got so many ways to harm people using something that could be called speech. Now, Jean Marie from San Francisco asks a question that's on my mind. Are there any contemporary philosophers working on an updated version of this harm principle?
So answer that briefly. We may take it up more at the break, but answer it now.
Well, Joel Feinberg wrote a 4-volume treatise about the moral limits of the criminal law in which he saw himself as defending basic Millian views about the limits of the criminal law. And he basically endorsed Mill's categories, including the idea that the harm principle is the main basis for restricting people's liberty.
Yeah, but
that's pre-internet.
Four volumes. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about Mill and the Good Life with David Brink from UC San Diego.
In a world defined by divisive rhetoric, groupthink, partisan divides, is there still room for Mill's tolerance and open debate? Or are Mill's principles outmoded relics of another time?
The relevance of Mill in our troubled and divided times, when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's my life, so what should anyone else get to say about it? I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is David Brink from UC San Diego, and we're thinking about Mill and the Good Life. And David, I want to shift our focus a little bit to the good life, because that's the part of Mill. I have to tell you, I'm no fan of utilitarianism as a moral theory, but I am a fan of Mill. Right, and the thing that makes me a fan of Mill is the stuff he says about individuality, self-cultivation, the importance of genius. This thing he says about he who lets his portion of the world or any portion of it choose his life for him has no need of no capacity except the ape-like one of imitation. He thinks that living a characteristically human life involves using all these capacities, right? I mean, and that seems like a self-regarding consideration about what I owe to myself. I owe to myself like a full self-development, not just to society for its good, but to me for my good. So tell me about that part of Mill.
Yeah, well, the defense of the perfectionism view comes out in utilitarianism, but a lot of it's just a claim directly about what's the good of an individual. And it's sort of a further question what the ethical significance of that is, whether we should care about the good of one of us and his higher capacities for his own sake, or whether we should care about it for the sake of what he could contribute to society as a whole. So you can, I mean, there are bits of Mill that are modular, right? One of the things that John's worry about the compatibility of On Liberty with utilitarianism brings up is that you might be really attracted to the claims about liberalism and individual rights in On Liberty, and you might not be as sanguine as Mill is about reconciling that with utilitarianism. And then maybe you should run with the liberalism rather than the utilitarianism. Also, within utilitarianism, you might be inspired by, or you might hate as elitist, Mill's claims about the higher pleasures doctrine, but you might then wonder whether that's just a recommendation about how individuals should shape their own lives, or whether it also implies something about the duty they owe to other people to help them live more elevated
lives. Tell me how to think about the following example that I give to my students. I'm always looking for a certain answer from them when I give them this example, but I see if I'm looking for the right answer, if I'm thinking of it the wrong way. So take Susie. Susie's a really brilliant student. She's a brilliant Stanford student. She's been working really hard. She gets straight A's. She wins a early fellowship to medical school. Her teachers think she's going to cure cancer or Alzheimer's or something, and they think, gosh, Susie, you're amazing, and all this social capital has been invested in Susie. But Susie, by the time she's done 4 years at Stanford, is burned out and decides what she's going to do is she's going to go to Hawaii, live on the beach, and smoke Kona Gold for the rest of her life and say, to heck with all that. Tell me how Mill would think about Susie.
Well, so Susie's an adult, so we don't have to worry about Mill's restriction that the arguments of On Liberty apply only to adults and the maturity of their faculties.
Right.
I think what we do is we respect her right to make that decision and the importance of autonomy to her own good, because we think if we forced her to do something else, we wouldn't be effectively promoting her good, because her good depends on it's originating from autonomous choice.
But she's wasting her talent. She's not cultivating herself.
So we have all these other options, and that's arguing with her, remonstrating with her, begging her to keep her options open. So maybe she does need to take a gap year and recharge her batteries, but she shouldn't do so in a way that forecloses all future opportunity to pursue her medical professional interests.
Do we owe it to Susie to remonstrate with her, to try and persuade her? Or do we say, oh, well, Susie, do we owe it to ourselves to try and argue her out of this or not? I mean, what do we owe her and what do we owe ourselves?
Well, I think that we owe it to her directly that we, because what one thing she's doing is she's considering using her autonomous powers to make a choice to relinquish or, you know, refuse to pursue her rational capacities in the future. In some ways, this is a little like an example Mill discusses, though he says at the beginning of On Liberty that paternalism is never permissible. He ends up by the end of On Liberty saying there's at least one exception, and it's an extreme case, and that's it's permissible to prohibit people from selling themselves into slavery. And what he says about that example is that the person is contemplating using her autonomy to abdicate her autonomy going forward. And so he says that the usual reasons we oppose paternalism here conspire to justify paternalistic interference. Now, I think Susie's case is a little different because she's not considering an irrevocable decision. But at least it has some elements of that case that she's considering using her autonomy to relinquish her autonomy, and Mill would be troubled by that. At least the first resort would be to remonstrate with her and argue with her, and we'd owe that both to her as a rational being, but we'd also, in virtue of our relationship with her, we'd owe it to her, I think.
What about the long-run interest of humankind considered as a progressive, or the permanent interest of humankind considered as a progressive species or something like that? How is Susie, by going off and smoking Kona Gold instead of going to medical school and serving the greater good because she's a brilliant person in whom lots of social capital has been invested, how is she serving that?
Well, she's not. That's the work. I mean, she's serving it in one way and not in another. She's serving it insofar as she's apparently, at least I'm assuming, made a reflective choice about how she wants to spend her immediate future and, for all we know, her indefinite future. But the content of her choice is such as to relinquish the exercise of her rational capacity. So you have, as it were, a conflict, a tension between her use of her capacities and the content of her choice. And if we measure both according to this perfectionist conception of the good, we find that, yes, there's something to be said for allowing her to make the choice, but she's also making the choice in such a way as to not honor these perfectionist values. And so, at least in the first instance, our response should be to engage her rational capacities and try to reason with her about it.
So, David, I want to ask you about another particular case that bothers me. I'm not lifelong, but 40, 45 years member of the ACLU. I love freedom of speech. I don't know if I'm an absolutist. But nowadays, you can do things like are done on the internet, like, you know, pasting Hillary Clinton's face on, you know, in a porn video or in a video of somebody doing something illegal. And you can do it so well that there's no way of telling, for at least for an ordinary person, if it's real or not. I don't think that's fair. And it's speech, but I don't think it should be allowed. I mean, how could I use Mills to help me in this case?
Yeah, well, so as Ken suggested earlier, some people, when they first read On Liberty, especially if they're just reading the chapter 2 on defending freedom of expression, come away with the impression that Mill is an absolutist. We find out in the beginning of the next chapter that at least he applies the harm principle. There's this famous mm-hmm. corn dealer case where he says that you're not allowed to smear the reputation of a corn dealer as starvers of poor in front of an angry crowd. And that's a sort of worry about inciting to violence, something like Holmes's clear and present danger test. But still, that might seem like a fairly libertarian view about freedom of expression. And at least one possibility that I've explored, and I have some, I think, is interesting possibility, is to ask whether the way Mill justifies freedom of expression gives him grounds for recognizing more forms of regulation, at least if not censorship. And what I have in mind is that in the explanation of why freedom of expression is so important that we touched on earlier, it seems as if we appeal to these rational capacities of people and the importance of freedom of expression to helping them make informed choices. And one way to summarize that would be to say that Mill's partly defending freedom of expression by its contribution to deliberative values. But if that's true, then it turns out that some exercises of freedom of expression might not contribute to, but might actually retard deliberative values. And so one possibility that Mill talks about is he might be in favor of what we would now call campaign finance restrictions, yeah, because he's worried about the influence of money on elections and public debate surrounding elections. But another thing more directly relevant to your example might be Mill's defense of various fairness in broadcasting doctrines and fact-checking procedures that would actually enhance the way in which speech would contribute to deliberative
David,
values.
I want to ask you one final question along this last line. Look, we live in this age of divisive rhetoric and groupthink and all this stuff. Is there any hope? And I think that's a cultural phenomenon, right? And Mill would hate all that stuff. Is there any hope that our culture will someday embody the kind of openness and tolerance and listening to all points of view that Mill believed in? Or do you think that's just a pipe dream? That's asking you about human beings. Can they actually live in a Millian way? What do you think?
Well, I guess I'd like to think it's not a pipe dream, but it's probably a sort of fragile achievement. And I think one of the things that tends to undermine the achievement is significant kinds of inequality. And this was something that concerned Mill in a number of contexts, where he thought that significant inequalities constrained fair opportunity for people to succeed in life. And I think when there are significant inequalities, not only is fair equality of opportunity compromised, but I think there tends to be sort of finger pointing and scapegoating. And I think that that leads to sort of partisan interactions, both in the public sphere and elsewhere. And so I think that Mill might have thought that one remedy or one hope for the greater sort of tolerant and robust deliberative interaction that he aspired to would require reductions of significant kinds of social and economic inequality.
Well, on that hopeful thought, I mean, because we can do that, perhaps. So there is some hope. So on that hopeful note, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been David Brink. He's a professor of philosophy at UC San Diego. He's author of Mill's Progressive Principles. So, John, are you having progressively better thoughts now?
Oh yes, as always. You know, the last few years I've mostly been studying Mill when I do his Principles of Logic, because his philosophy of language is also very important. But, you know, working on this show, he's really an extremely important philosopher. And then the combination of him and his wife, Harriet, with the subjugation of women and roughly the same era, Wollstonecraft, those are ideas that have taken a century and a half to really...
Yeah,
set in, but he was at the forefront. Whether he was there on his own or was kicked up in front by his wife, I don't know. Anyway, good for Mill.
Mill's a great philosopher, and I recommend, if you haven't read Mill, you should read Mill. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with no apologies whatsoever to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org. We might feature it on our blog. Now, the greatest speed for the greatest number of listeners. Let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, by the 19th century, the Enlightenment had morphed into a kind of liberal imperialism. The sun never set in the British Empire, and the sun was better for it. If you looked up civilization in the encyclopedia, it would show England. And, of course, John Stuart Mill was the guy who wrote the encyclopedia, or at least the essay on the treatment of barbarous nations. Quote, "Nations which are still barbarous have not got beyond the period during which it is likely to be for their benefit that they should be conquered, and held to subjection by foreigners. A violation of great principles of morality it may easily be. But barbarians have no rights as a nation except a right to such treatment as may fit them for becoming one," unquote. The burden to be nice is on England, but they do not have to lift it. It's implicit, so need not be shown. Niceness from barbarians, however, is just a trick, a moment. It is not essential. It proves nothing. Today, of course, we've grown bored with civilization. Democracy demands too much free speech on the one hand. We're tired of being persuaded. And we have to embrace inclusivity on the other. The melting pot churns. We are exhausted by what once gave us pleasure. Angry at those who are enthusiastic about what we take for granted. The word barbarian came from a Greek word, which was onomatopoeia, for what not Greek language sounded like to Greeks. Bar, 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 bar. Now we've opened the gates to barbarians, my friends. English is already overrun with words grabbed from other tongues, like rendezvous and totem and avatar, bungalow, loot, and thug. Mill wrote, quote, "Actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness," unquote. His utilitarianism was determined by pleasure, tempered by not hampering the pleasure of others. His brand called for self-interest, enlightened by responsibility, concern for others, progressive values. He was an early advocate for women's suffrage. He used free speech dutifully, lest it be lost. I am sure that the very act of thinking about the best way for human beings and civilization to thrive brought him pleasure, which would be a self-serving way to be a selfless person. Pleasure was defined as either high or low. High would be opera, for example. Low would be, to use Jeremy Bentham's example, hopscotch. One requires the machinery of the state, or at least the culture of the state, orchestras, singers, theaters, fabulous outfits, fine dining, bubbly wine afterwards. The other requires a sidewalk and a piece of chalk. Pleasures have gotten more diverse and more refined over the years. Opera requires more and more money to keep going and competes with ballet, theater, the symphony for funding. Football and basketball eat up the money for arenas and stadiums. Whither hopscotch? Well, drawing on the sidewalk could get you arrested for defacing public property. Cheating and doping have robbed us of pleasure in many sports. Willful ignorance, zealotry, and bullheadedness have robbed our political discourse of zest. Music is bad, pornography is free, movies are expensive, the internet is horrible, and we have the attention span of hyperactive two-year-olds. Not only that, we thought for a moment we had come to the end of history, entering a new phase of enlightened elites, feeding the hungry and funding museums till the meat-free, mutated cows come home. Instead, we have an elite that seems to be only interested in leveraging debt and taking selfies at the disco. And we're back with the same old edifice of claptrap we thought had been torn down, just more expensive and with more niches. Football, basketball, communist, fascist, East Coast, West Coast, man, woman, cisgen, transgen, puppy, kitten, morning, night. Niches make enemies. When I take pleasure in the displeasure of others, we are all barbarians in this bus. We don't listen. Bar, 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 bar. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantorn.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I love you, Margaret, but this is my life. I'll decide what to do with it.